After your experience in the governor's office, what would have led you in 2002 to run for office again, and this time against Senator Inhofe? I guess this would be his second term?
Yeah.
That he was running for?
It would have to have been his third. I think he'd been in for a while.
All right. And so he was well established. You had this experience. Some of it was good. Some of it was bad.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, it was a, I think somebody had made an argument to me that, you know, you're always going to have that ketchup stain on the front of your shirt because of all the controversy that Ed Gaylord and others manufactured until you win another election. So I think that sort of stuck in the back of my mind. But more importantly, I was just amazed at, and I think Jim Inhofe's probably a decent enough person, but he just seemed to be a really bad senator. If I looked at the amount of highway funding that we got back, as poor as we are, we were a donor state in almost every category. And that changes from time to time. But at that time, we were paying for highways in New Jersey with our tax dollars. We didn't have people there beating it to death to make sure that we got everything we needed. And there was so much more to do. I guess they were in the minority, I believe, at the time. And his vote was so predictable and so right edge all the time that it took away all of the negotiating capacity for getting good things done in the state. So if I was in the middle, I might vote with a Democratic majority. I might not. If I'd mix it up a little bit, I could get so much more done in the state because that vote's going to be a lot more valuable. And Jim is so predictable in terms of how he's going to vote that I can't imagine going out of your way to try to do anything for the state on his behalf because of it. Seniority now makes a difference. So there's a lot of counter arguments, but I was just moved by the spirit. I could not believe that as poorly as I thought he was doing, no one was going to challenge him. And I knew it was an uphill fight, and it was. We were not successful in that. I think we ran a pretty respectable campaign, but not enough to come close to winning.
But it was at a time, too, where Republicans had such a stronghold in the state, and here you are, a Democrat, and even today in 2020, we still have that going on. So you already had a stain on your forehead.
Yeah.
You were D.
Yeah. The demographics had definitely, the makeup of the voter base had definitely changed. All of that had taken place. And then in the middle of that, you've got 9/11, which had occurred, which normally, except in the case of this pandemic and our current president, normally a national tragedy like that inures to the benefit of incumbents. And that was the case here. You wave the flag, you express sympathy, and you're going to do well. We had everybody out here campaigning against us, the president, the vice president, they were all here. So,
was it tough to be defeated again?
Not so much. I think, again, it probably was a little bit more like 1986. I knew it was a long shot. It was like Don Quixote. I mean, it was tilting at the stars. But I felt it important. It's the reason I stay active now. I mean, it's just insane that I stay active in party politics and that I serve on the DNC and on the executive committee and all this other stuff.
At a national level.
At a national level. You know, I should take a lesson from other former Democratic governors and give it a rest. But there's a public policy enthusiasm about me because I saw it firsthand. Now, a lot of it got wiped out pretty quickly, but I saw firsthand what one person can do in politics. Or not one person, but one person can get a collaboration started and eventually build a coalition. And the next thing you know, you pass House Bill 1017 and you fully funded and you've got almost a 40% increase in public education funding. I mean, those things happen. But it takes a one-mindedness that I've had over the time. And frankly, I still share that. I call myself a business and public policy enthusiast.
Yeah. The state is hammering out a budget as we speak. Here it is Friday, and I suppose they've come to the end of that. But I thought about you. The headline in our paper yesterday was four Stitt vetoes overridden. It was historic. The legislature overrode the vetoes, the general appropriations bill, three other budget-related measures, and the legislature is dominated by the governor's own party, for those who will be listening back to this, as Republican. So it was his own party who rejected it, and that was historic. You might have a comment on that, but I was wondering then, did you have difficulty hammering out a budget? What was your legislature, the makeup of it?
All Democrat.
All Democrat. So you didn't have that problem. But he has a problem with his own party.
I had exactly the same problem, sadly. In fact, I would put my override numbers up against however long Kevin Stitt serves. I can't put his 8 years against my four, but I'll guarantee you that I had more overrides in my 4 years than he had.
Well, he's only done 2 years.
He's only done two, but I mean, dozens, literally. The legislature enjoyed overriding big bills and simple bills. There was a lot of goofy stuff that gets passed, and I wasn't bashful about vetoing it. Afterwards, it became kind of a thing for governors not to be overridden. And so in the recent past, Keating was just, I'm not sure he ever got overridden. And I'm not sure Henry did, maybe he did, but not at the volume that we had. Again, we're radioactive half the time. I wasn't bashful about vetoing things. And the legislature was always, you know, I came out for term limits when I ran for office. I didn't come out for a vote of the people on taxes. I just said I wasn't going to raise taxes. We were going to figure out a different way to do this. And so I did things like the Indian compacts and bond issues and what have you. But I think the interesting thing is if you cut one layer into this, it is really a very specific fight between the Republican leadership of the legislature and this Republican governor who is like me, you know, imbued with a little arrogance when he came in and a little naivete and maybe even knows less about state government than I knew at the time. I think you put all that together and he seems to be quite stubborn. So when he locks in on something, and supporters of Donald Trump, I think, see this as the new normal, that boy, you just do something out there and then you never move. You never apologize, never move, you never back down. And so I think that exists there a lot. The other interesting thing is our Native American tribes, you know, we've got several that are multi-billion dollar budgets. These are huge and thankfully very well run operations. And they are 10 times more influential than our utility enterprise ever hoped to be back in the day when utilities seemed to be dominating everything. The legislature gets that, and they are lockstep with Native American tribes, and the governor has very clumsily tried to get in there and change the compacts, and they're all eager to do it. You could fix this in 5 minutes. You basically go in and say, listen, you're paying an average of whatever it is, 4% at the moment. Let's pretend you're going to pay 6%. And I'll pretend that these things renew, and let's sign it up. And all of a sudden, the governor will be a hero and will have increased the money from Indian tribes by 50%, for God's sakes, and it's done. Instead, they've had this long, drawn-out, distracting, expensive fight that is threatening. When I came in, relationships with tribes were terrible. I went to Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and I stood behind a podium, and I said, I endorse the sovereignty of your nation. No governor had said that before that. I got rid of all those 9 attorneys, and we started negotiating compacts. We had a big listening conference, although we didn't know to call it then. So I feel badly that this governor has, boy, if there's an economic engine not to trifle with, it's that one. You know, they're keeping us alive in rural Oklahoma with just their contributions to rural health care. We're closing hospitals, and they're opening care facilities at twice the rate that we're closing. So it's too bad.
He wants to raise the rate from 4% to, is it up to 10%?
I don't know what these.
But it's significantly higher.
Yeah.
That's the major issue.
They had a negotiating position. They'd be very happy. And who knows what that rate would be. I think, had they not created such bad blood, because now I think they fear we're not respected. They don't understand our economic engine. You know, the Cherokees alone contribute to 165 public schools. They don't have to do that. They're building roads and highways and open up health care facilities to non-members. There's all kinds of stuff that they don't have to do. And what I fear is we're going to see a retrenchment of that because we've had nothing but excellent relationships for the last 25 years with our Native American tribes. And they've only grown stronger, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars. Not that they don't have other business interests, but 169 casinos in our state is not anything to be trifled with, you know, for something that's outlawed for the rest of us.